it was. Once the ship's location had become common knowledge, news helicopters had raced to catch a glimpse of whatever they could. They didn't seem to care that the military had declared a no-fly zone over the entire western part of the Gulf. Why should they? This was the biggest news event of the century. Heck, it was the biggest news story ever. And weren't reporters ravenous for Pulitzers and Peabodys the way actors craved Oscars and Golden Globes? The accidents that had followed were hardly a surprise. Yesterday, a chopper for Miami's WPLG News had collided with New Orleans' Fox 8 a few miles from the rig. All on board were killed, including a top reporter from each station. The resulting blame game had only made a bad situation worse and fed the online conspiracies that the military had shot them down for straying too close. These were crazy times, made far crazier by the public's insatiable need to know. It didn't matter that only dribbles of truth were being served up with an abundance of theory and conjecture, and it was the same pattern Mia had witnessed from the moment those images of the ship had first showed up in the news and online. To put it bluntly, the world was shitting itself, and she was partly to blame. In moments like these, when she had time to be alone with her thoughts, the role she might have played in stirring the insanity pot began to meld with her anxiety over Zoe's health. It was then that she took a deep breath and tried to keep her eyes on the prize. Oh, how a Xanax or a Valium would help take that searing edge off. She could feel her physiology begin to react at the mere thought of self-medicating. The muscles in her stomach began to seize into a painful knot. Bolts of electricity shot up her legs. Mia had been down that road before, more than once, and every time it had always ended in the same dark place. Speaking of dark places, there was another one not too far away, a real place referred to as the lab, a spot down in the bowels of that monstrous gunmetal ship she'd eyed through the submersible's porthole window. That was where Jack, Tom, and Sven were right now, searching for a DNA databank Anna suggested they would find there. Understanding which species had been grown in those tubes and sent to the surface might better help them figure out why these beings had come here in the first place. When it came to sequencing the alien genome, she hadn't expected the biological matter Jack found to provide much of a genetic signature. Not only on account of its age, 65 million years was a heck of a long time, but also because there was nothing to say that all life in the universe was carbon-based, and no carbon meant no DNA. The sequencer made a low beeping sound, indicating that it was finished. Mia scanned the results, and as she did, the color began to slowly drain from her face. She had been wrong. The alien's genetic material was carbon-based. But more than that, when she compared their genome to ours, she saw that 75% of our DNA was the same. Then, with the comparison complete, the computer spat out one additional point of commonality. Mia slumped into the chair, not at all ready for what she was seeing. The alien had Salzburg. Chapter 60. Mia climbed up one level to find Hart at comms. "You're white as a sheet," he said, rising to his feet. "Everything all right?"
"I'm not sure."
She stumbled up the circular stairwell that led to the orb's mess, clawing at the railing as she went. She braced herself against the bulkhead, drawing in a deep breath, the muscles in her chest constricting painfully. When she had things at least partially under control, Mia broadcast to Tom and the others.
"Are you guys still in the lab?"
"Affirmative," Tom replied jovially. "We're heading back now."
"Mia, you will not believe this place."
"Did you find what you were looking for?"
she asked, still struggling to control her breathing.
"You sound stressed," Sven said, his deep voice even lower over the radio. "Are you hurt?"
"No, but I need to know if you found the library you were looking for."
"We did," Jack assured her. "Anna sent the elevator down to get us. We won't be long."
Mia caught a rustling behind her. She turned to see a woman in a blue bio suit emerging from the submersible.
"Dr. Ward, is it?" the woman asked. "Did you just arrive?" Mia replied, still feeling a touch disoriented. The implications of what she'd stumbled upon moments ago were so vast she was having trouble processing it. We've been here a while, the woman said. I'm Lieutenant Brooks with the ONI. Strands of her hair were waving free from her bun at the back. It looked as though she'd been asleep or engaged in some challenging manual labor. I expect, while you're here, that any and all pertinent discoveries will be shared with Naval Intelligence. Mia swallowed.
Yes, of course.
As far as she was concerned, she had no reason to hold on to the secret. Surely the military could be trusted. But that nagging feeling kept creeping back in. She'd learned the hard way what happened when you trusted the wrong person. The ONI had their own mission, and for all Mia knew, classifying her discovery as top secret could stifle any future research into fighting Salzburg. We're all on the same team, Brooks assured her. Mia watched as she spoke, noticing how the woman's gums were more prominent than her teeth. She remembered seeing the same thing among great white sharks on a discovery program. We have files on everyone here, Brooks went on, scooping her helmet off the table. I'm only here to study biological samples, Mia protested. She wasn't looking for trouble, and wasn't sure why the woman was sizing her up like this. Once we know what we have, we'll be happy to share it with you. So you have something? Brooks' eyes narrowed. I didn't say that. No, but you implied it. Let's cut the bull. We know very well why you're here, Mia. You want to save your daughter. Mia felt heat rise up her neck and into her face. Excuse me? We also know about your little stint in rehab. Yes, of course. Why wouldn't we know? Don't think you weren't vetted before the Navy allowed you to come to a highly sensitive facility. Mia put her hand to her head. The room was starting to spin. Was she having trouble adjusting to the change in pressure in the orb? I'm not sure what any of this has to do with my daughter. It has everything to do with your objectivity, Brooks said, folding the helmet under her arm. The human race is at the most critical crossroads in its history, and you've got one person on your mind. What about the rest of the country? Or the rest of the world, Mia added, suddenly wondering if Brooks was right. Had she been so laser-focused on finding a treatment for Salzburg that she'd lost her way? The whoosh of the inner airlock opening sounded behind her. Brooks leaned in. Like I said, we're in the intelligence business. We know what you're going to do, even before you do. When the time comes, make sure you remember whose side you're on. Brooks strode toward the airlock, acknowledging Jack and the others as she went by.
What was that all about? Tom asked, alarm growing in his voice when he saw Mia's face.
Mia spun and watched Brooks close the airlock behind her. I think she was threatening me. Chapter 61. Jack followed Mia down to the orb's lab to process the DNA samples he'd retrieved from the ship's library. He had suspected for quite some time that if such a database existed, it would likely be located close to the chamber the animal was incubated in, a DNA master file of sorts that could be copied whenever a particular species was ordered up. The tricky part was waiting for Anna, still on the bridge, to remotely open the trade door housed beneath the glass enclosure. She repeated the commands for two additional pods. Since arriving, they had only seen a single source of activity in the alien lab. If other species had also been manufactured, recognizable or not, Jack felt it was important to know. Mia inserted all three samples and set the machine to sequence the genome for each.
I saw what Brooks did back there, Jack said, half seated on the table before her.
Mia's expression hardened. If you'd arrived sooner, you would have caught the whole show.
Intimidation's her only weapon, he said. She's trying to remind you who's in charge.
Tom and Sven came down, the larger man having trouble navigating the narrow stairwell.
Hope we're not interrupting anything, Tom said, not sounding very genuine.
The more the merrier, Jack offered, waving them into the tight space.
He turned back to her.
You want to fill us in on what got you so spooked?
She ran her hand along the table's surface, distinctly aware of the hardened plastic it was molded from. She then told them what she had found.
Jack remained quiet, then asked, What do you suppose it means?
As far as I can tell, it's pretty clear, she replied, her hands clasped together now. Genetically speaking, those praying mantis people you found mummified in the hold of the ship are our distant cousins.
Not only us, Jack said. That means they're related to all life on Earth.
Tom cleared his throat, painfully aware he was in over his head.
How's that even possible?
Panspermia, Sven said,
the word surprising even himself.
It's the idea that microbes blasted into space could seed other planets. Some have theorized that was how life may have gotten started on Earth. I think what Dr. Smith, I mean Sven, is suggesting is that process may have happened in reverse.
Mia wasn't so sure. So a piece of Earth rock gets blasted into orbit and somehow lands on a planet in another solar system, laying the foundations for an insectoid race?
Saw it in a movie once,
Sven said, grinning sheepishly.
The aliens came back to reclaim their old home. Then a big war broke out.
Just then, results for the first two specimens came back. They studied the screen as the computer searched for a match among animal species on Earth. The first sample returned no known matches. The second found a name. Messenix. Jack's eyebrows rose up. Mia, too, looked surprised. Tom and Sven were lost.
Is that a good thing?
Tom asked, his gaze bouncing between them. Neither good nor bad, Mia told them. But definitely a surprise. See, 50 million years ago, Messenix was a wolf-like creature that lived and hunted on land. Perhaps due to environmental pressures such as changes in climate, scarcity of prey, or threats from larger mammals, they began spending more time in the sea. Slowly, over millions of years of natural selection, they evolved into the aquatic species we know today as dolphins.
First early man, Jack said under his breath, and now early dolphins.
A picture was beginning to form. That was when the computer finished analyzing the template DNA belonging to the proto-primate Plessy. On a hunch, Mia asked the computer to compare this template sample from the alien lab to the genome she'd developed earlier from the Plessy ejected from the ship. Mia filled them in on what she was doing. The incubation chamber used this very sample as the template to create the archaic primate species you watched grow to near adulthood.
That was before it was sucked out of the artificial womb, Jack added, and fired from the ship in one of those pods. But if one is merely a template, then they should be identical, so why are you comparing the two?
The computer zeroed in on a segment of DNA, flashing a red light. There's a section that doesn't match, Mia said. She ran a further test to isolate the discrepancy.
Could it be a mistake during the replication phase? Jack wondered.
Mia felt the breath catch in her throat. The error occurred in a single gene, altering the protein it produced and its effects on the organism.
A mutation, Jack said,
watching in awe as Mia's fingers flowed across the keyboard.
But what was the new gene that formed?
A moment later, they had their answer. Monoamine oxidase A, she said, her pulse fluttering, otherwise known as MAOA.
That's all great, Tom said, wringing his hands. But what is it?
Jack turned and regarded both men.
The gene that controls violence and aggression.
Chapter 62. The normally smooth skin on Mia's brow wrinkled, as it always did when confronting a big discovery.
It's nicknamed the warrior gene, she said. Monoamine oxidase A is an enzyme that breaks down neurotransmitters in the brain. Dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin. The MAOA gene helps to regulate this enzyme. Humans carry various forms of the gene, resulting in different levels of enzymatic activity. In other words, people with one type, MAOA-L, produce less of the enzyme and thus show a far greater tendency toward violent behavior, while those with the MAOA-H version produce more of the enzyme and demonstrate far more empathy and kindness.
A good versus evil gene, Tom said, gripping the armrests of the chair he was sitting in.
Certainly looks that way, she replied.
Jack scratched his chin. What about the second specimen you tested from the alien lab, the template for the Messenix? Did it show any signs of MAOA?
None whatsoever, she replied. But we would need to run through every DNA template the ship has in order to rule them all out. Dr. Greer, Anna called over the radio.
The muscles in Jack's jaw seized up. Anna, is everything all right?
It is, Dr. Greer, although I must admit to listening in.
Although they were on the orb, Jack became distinctly aware he was still wearing his OHMD glasses, which had allowed her to listen in on the conversation.
That's fine, Anna. Would you like to add something to the discussion?
Not at the moment, she replied, But given your recent discovery, there's a file in the ship's archive that you may find particularly illuminating.
They all exchanged a curious glance.
After suiting up, Jack found Commander Hart at the comm center and asked if he'd seen or heard from the ONI team. The edges of the seal's mouth turned down as he shook his head.
"Can't say I have, Doc. Last I heard, they were searching for the ship's propulsion system. I did see Lieutenant Brooks was in the orb about an hour ago. Want me to scan the radio channels and send them a message?"
Jack considered the idea.
"I may not be their biggest fan, but I do want to make sure they're not in any kind of trouble."
"You think they may have found something big and are keeping it quiet?" he asked, cocking an eye.
"The thought had crossed my mind," he admitted. "It's not like them to keep out of sight."
Hart laughed. "You do have a point. Most of the time they're banging around with salvaged tech and stuffing it into the submersible."
"Appreciate it," Jack said, walking away.
By the time he reached the mess, a vague sense of uneasiness was stirring deep inside his gut, a feeling that would continue to nag him long after they reached the bridge.
Chapter 63.
While Jack was wrestling with an uneasy feeling he couldn't quite put his finger on, Mia was in the process of stepping into a strange new world. Her vitals spiked as the inner airlock door sealed shut and the one leading down the ladder into the ship swung open. She had grown used to the biosuit, opting to keep it on even while on the orb for that very purpose. Her breathing came in short, ragged bursts. On the main platform, she stood frozen in place, her knees weakened by the immensity of the structure. Inevitably, her gaze was drawn to the central column and the narrow walkways radiating out from each level. But it was the pastel-colored lights shimmering up the body of the cylinder she found hypnotic to behold. The sensation was similar to finding yourself in a wonderful dream, the kind you hated waking up from. Jack reached out and touched her arm. Despite the suit's robust organic polymer, his touch was welcomed and reassuring. When their eyes met, she caught a hint of envy.
"I wish I could join you in seeing it again for the first time," he said. They headed toward the closest bulkhead and a set of ramps which led up several levels to the bridge.
The muscles in Mia's legs began to burn. "Why not take the elevator?" she asked. Jack smiled.
"I figured you'd want to get a look around on your first trip inside."
Soon, they reached the bridge. Anna was there to greet them. She rolled forward, extending one of her robotic arms, her digital features lit with a beaming smile. Jack introduced them, one at a time.
"She's a robot," Mia said, shocked.
"A glorified toaster," Jack admitted, grinning. "Yeah, that was my first reaction, too, at least before I got to know her. You'll find she's so much more than what you expect."
Mia contemplated this as she shook Anna's hand.
"Dr. Ward has a special project for you, Anna," Jack told her, "one that I'm sure you'll enjoy."
"I cannot wait to hear about this special project," she replied, leading them back to the main console.
"But first, what is it you have to show us?" Jack asked.
Anna tapped the screen and then waved her arms, scrolling through the holographic options swirling before them.
"If you recall, Dr. Greer, the lab specimen ejected from the craft was tracked by a recording system."
"The specimen that died soon after breathing 21st century air," Jack said.
Anna nodded.
"Yes, I considered this as I listened in on your conversation about the MAOA gene you found in the deceased animal's genome. If the pod had made a recording of that event, why would pods ejected earlier not have done the same?"
Jack was intrigued. "That would give us a visual record of the species dispersed from the ship."
"Correct. After rolling back through the archives, it became abundantly clear that the bulk of the ship's activity occurred within a few hundred years after the impact and the resulting mass extinction."
Mia found the idea of images from 65 million years ago fascinating.
"How many pods were sent out at the time?" she asked.
1,500, Anna replied, "although there were 2 to 4 creatures of the same species in each pod, often 2 males and 2 females. It should also be noted that some of the pods traveled vast distances."
"The aliens were repopulating the planet," Tom said, "like some sort of technological Noah."
"How many video records have you found?" Jack asked, feeling the excitement dancing along every nerve ending.
"I have found recordings for each of the 1,500 ejections. However, there is one in particular worth viewing."
Anna made a swiping motion with her robotic arm. The green, glowing hologram disappeared, soon replaced by a flat, moving image that seemed to curve in on itself. It was as though the video were being projected on the inside of a sphere, with the effect that it could be viewed perfectly from any position on the bridge. Images appeared of a pod speeding toward the Earth, slicing through thick white clouds. Moments later, a sparse landscape came into view. From this high up, it was obvious the Earth had already been blackened and ravaged by the tremendous impact. But it was also clear that life, resilient as it was, had begun to reclaim the devastated lands. Among the ruins, oases of green foliage dotted the area. And it was into one of these islands of life that the pod landed. Clouds of dust rose up as it struck the supple earth. A door opened, and two furry plessies charged out. Several seconds passed before two more followed. The last pair approached their new surroundings with caution. They skulked around, listening intently for danger. Anna flipped ahead a few days. By now, the animals had all climbed into a nearby tree and created a nest, but only one male and two females were visible. "Wait a minute," Jack said, noticing the numbers were off. "Where's the other male?" Anna scrolled back several hours to reveal a scene where one of the males was chasing the other, squealing and biting. The scene continued for several minutes, those on the bridge feeling as though they were watching a PBS nature show set 65 million years in the past. Then it happened. The more aggressive Plessy caught up with his wounded brother and sank a mouthful of sharpened teeth into his opponent's furry neck, staining the jungle floor red with blood. The animal twitched a final time before his body grew still. "Do you understand?" Anna asked as the video ended. Jack stared at the image of the dead creature frozen on the holographic display. "It seemed that only one of the males had the aggressive version of the MAOA gene," he said, the full impact only starting to dawn on him. "The violent one wanted both of the females for himself," Tom said. "Wanted to be top dog and decided to wipe out his competition." "Were any other proto-primates sent out?" Jack asked. So much would hinge on the answer Anna gave next. Slowly, Anna shook her head. "No other pods with Plesiatopiformes were released." "So, you're telling us," Tom said, unable to hide his own sense of astonishment, "that the aggressive little bastard who did the killing is man's earliest ancestor," Mia said, completing Tom's thought.
"And if the other had lived instead?" Sven asked.
Jack raised his eyebrows.
"Then the human race might have been vastly different."
Mia thought of the chaos going on in the world above them. "We sure as heck wouldn't be so eager to murder one another, that's for sure." Tom ran his hands through his hair.
"So man's legacy of murder and conquest all comes down to a snippet of DNA that got copied wrong."
"History has turned on far less," Jack offered.
Mia grew quiet, unable to stop thinking about her time spent in Sunday school as a child. There was something about what they'd seen just now that bore a familiar ring to it. She thought of Sven's question about what the world might have been like had the more peaceful Plessy lived instead. And that was when it came to her. "This was man's fall from grace," she blurted out. They regarded her with surprise, except for Anna, who remained stoic.
"What are you saying?" Jack asked.
"I remember the pastor at my church discussing how man's lust for power and greed had led to his banishment from the Garden of Eden, a fall from grace which has haunted us ever since. I recall wondering even then how I could possibly be held responsible for an original sin I had no part in committing. As a teenager, I discarded what I considered an archaic and outdated belief system without realizing the grain of truth it contained. By killing his rival, the real Adam ensured that his violent genetic tendencies would be passed to his descendants, tainting the entire primate and human family tree."
Chapter 64.
They were still reeling from what Mia had told them when the holographic display retreated, revealing the countdown clock.
"Wait a minute, when did that pop up?"
Jack said with alarm. Anna studied the alien symbols she now recognized were numbers, counting down to the next blast wave. "I'm afraid there is no way to be certain. It must have been obstructed by the video."
That means we have an hour, Jack told everyone, quickly explaining the clock and its significance.
I'm sorry to disagree with you, Dr. Greer, but there are only 28 minutes until the next event.
A mix of fear and despair lodged in Mia's chest.
But there's still so much to do, she said.
She was thinking not only about the insights they might have gained about Salzburg and how to beat it, but also about the other secrets of Earth's evolution yet to be discovered on board. They heard a crackle in their ear as Commander Hart joined the radio channel.
Jack, are you there?
Was this about the timer? And if so, how could Hart have known about it?
I'm here. Go ahead. You need to get back to the orb right away, he said.
I know, Jack replied. The countdown started again, and this time I don't think the ship will make it through another blast.
Jack caught a thread of fear in Hart's voice.
That's not our biggest problem, the SEAL told them.
I just got done speaking with Admiral Stark when he told me the team from the ONI had arrived from Maryland, said they got held up a few days to receive specialized training.
I'm not following you, Jack replied. Captain Kelly and the Naval Intelligence Team have been here for days.
No, Jack. They're scrambling up there to figure out what the hell's going on. There was a Captain Kelly and a Lieutenant Brooks, but they died in Iraq more than 10 years ago. Whoever those people are, I can assure you they aren't Naval Intelligence.
Are we in danger, Dr. Greer?
Anna asked with the innocence of a young child. More than you know, Jack replied, then to Hart. We're heading back to the orb now. Do we have anything to defend ourselves with, in case Kelly and the others show up?
I've got a pistol, Hart said.
Jack couldn't help but laugh. When he'd asked Hart earlier about weapons, the SEAL had told him there would be no need for them down here. Jack was happy he'd lied. Anna summoned the lift up to the bridge. Heavy vibrations rattled their bones. A low hum crawled through their helmets and into their ears. The lift was on its way. Jack knew there was still time to escape the ship, but that wasn't what worried him. It was the imposters on board, a group he could only imagine was made up of Sentinel agents. He gritted his teeth, remembering how they had systematically pillaged everything they could lay their hands on. And then, when most of it was gone, they too had disappeared down below.
Jack, it's Hart. I'm prepping the submersible. I need you and your team to double-time it.
Working on it, Jack replied, feeling the bridge rattle beneath his feet as the lift worked its way up the long column. Hart started to say something else when his voice cut off. A split second later, they heard a loud explosion 3 levels beneath them.
Hart, are you there?
Jack asked, concerned. The lift doors squealed open and they stepped in. In a moment, they were heading down to where the orb was docked. But despite repeated calls, Hart didn't respond, and Jack was powerless to claw back the sinking feeling. All of them were about to die.
Chapter 65.
When the lift opened, Mia charged along the catwalk and stopped halfway to the platform. Below her, the central core of the ship descended into incredible darkness. Before her, in the distance, was the ladder that led to the orb. Although her helmet blocked most of the ambient sound, she didn't need sound to see the water collecting along the bottom rung. They continued on, if only to be sure. As they proceeded, Jack gave them hand signals, indicating the alternate channel they should switch to. There was hardly a question that Kelly's people would be listening in. Once at the stairwell, Tom leapt up the ladder in quick order to check on the orb. Salt water foamed at their feet as the others backed away and waited for him to return. A moment later, he came sliding back down, gripping the ladder's edges.
"It's gone," he said in shock.
By the sound of his speech, it was clear the moisture in Tom's mouth was gone, too.
The airlock door connected to the ship is still in place, but it's been severely damaged. There's no telling how long before it gives way and the sea comes pouring in.
Tom had no sooner finished what he was saying than they felt tremors from a fresh explosion down below. Jack went to the railing along the platform and peered down to see an orange glow on one of the lower levels.
They meant to trap us here, he said, searching around frantically for options.
None of them needed to ask why. The answer was obvious. Sentinel knew that it was only a matter of time before someone saw through their charade. And there was only one way to make sure the truth of what was discovered stayed buried forever. Like so many fanatical groups before them, they were hell-bent on seeing it through, even if that meant sacrificing their own lives in the process.
Commander Hart never mentioned them leaving in the submersible, Mia said.
Sven balled his hands into fists.
Which means they're still here somewhere.
They want to make sure we don't find a way out, Tom said, seething.
For Mia, The sadness of failing Zoe was just as devastating as the idea of dying 2,000 feet beneath the ocean. She was battling the sense of panic growing inside of her when she had an idea.
Maybe there's a way off the ship.
Jack caught on at once. They could use one of the pods in the lab down below. Another explosion shook them.
Then we need to get down there before they destroy our only hope of escape, Jack told them.
Hold on, Tom said, calling them back. If Sentinel managed to sneak bombs on board, then there's a good chance they're armed.
He was right, Jack realized with growing alarm. They had already lost their most viable way off the ship. Now they had to contend with bombs and firearms. He turned to Anna.
When you were searching through the ship's computer, did you come across any information on a weapons locker or anything else we could use?
I'm afraid not, Dr. Greer, she replied, a sullen expression on her face.
Wait a minute, Mia blurted out with excitement. Didn't you say Dr. Bishop found a pile of junk a few levels beneath us?
Jack nodded. It was a repair depot. What about it?
Maybe it will have something we can use.
With traces of smoke wafting past them, the group hurried back on the lift and headed 3 levels down.
What do you think the chances are they'll have a laser gun hanging around?
Sven asked, hopeful. Mia wanted to smile, but couldn't.
I don't know about you, but right now I'd be happy with a wrench.
Another explosion rocked the ship as they scoured the workshop for anything useful. With laser guns and wrenches in short supply, they each grabbed a patchwork of discarded metal pieces. They were looking for anything with a sharpened tip to stab with, or a rounded end they could swing as a club. The irony of their situation was not lost on Jack. They were on the most technologically advanced craft on Earth and were reduced to wielding medieval weaponry. Within minutes, they were back on the lift, heading down to where the man pretending to be Captain Kelly and the other Sentinel agents were surely waiting for them. Jack fought hard to silence the nervous energy coursing through his limbs. They would get one shot at this, and if anything went wrong, all of them were sure to die.
Anna, how long before that next blast wave?
9 minutes, 43 seconds, and
that's good enough.
Addressing the others, Jack said, any suggestions on how to handle these Sentinel goons?
Find the biggest one among them, Tom said, clenching his fist, and take him out first.
The lift door slid open. Through the clouds of black smoke, they spotted the archway that led to the pod room, but beyond that appeared the vague outline of a human figure. As they suspected, Captain Kelly had known they would come, known there was no other choice. Behind them, seawater came splashing down the ramp. The airlock door must have blown. Jack wondered whether it was better to be shot or to drown.
Something told him he was about to find out.
Chapter 66.
With time slipping away, they entered the pod chamber, ready to roll the dice. Captain Kelly stood before the first row of pods. The composite glass doors were cracked and, in some cases, completely shattered. Jack's eyes drifted to the control panels. They, too, had been smashed. Kelly caught Jack's gaze, then tapped the side of his helmet and raised an index finger. They switched to Channel 1.
"Took us a while to break the glass," Captain Kelly told them.
He seemed calm, like a man who was resigned to his fate.
"Turned out the stuff was a hell of a lot stronger than we thought. The control panels, too. What I wouldn't have given for a material that strong on my dad's Buick when I wrapped it around that telephone pole. I was young and drunk, and might have saved myself from losing my girlfriend and doing 6 years for manslaughter. It's amazing how you can turn your life around when you have the time to consider what you've done."
Lieutenant Brooks appeared from out of the smoke, along with 4 of Kelly's men. They moved close to their boss. Jack spun to find the last 2 Sentinel agents. Each was armed, the barrels of their pistols pointed right at them. They were trapped, but Jack hadn't expected anything less. As the 2 groups stood facing one another, water continued to rush in, splashing down the ramps as it collected in the lower levels.
"I don't have to tell you, your chances of making it out alive aren't looking good,"
Kelly informed them, a sick grin on his face. He pointed to a block of C4 wedged between 2 pods.
"But I'm prepared to make a deal with you."
He turned to Mia.
"All the pods are broken," he told her, "except for one, number 37, way at the back."
The grin on his face showed he knew about her trip to Kathmandu.
Go ahead and hand me Dr. Salzberg's USB, and I'll let you take your chances on lucky number 37. And the rest of us? Tom asked. Kelly snickered. Traitors to the cause don't get special treatment. People like you never understood. We're doing this because we love the human race, want to prevent the Holocaust we know is coming. Fear is man's greatest weakness, but it can also be his greatest strength, the only shield our species possesses against its own demise.
As Captain Kelly justified his lunacy, letters began to appear one by one on the inside of Jack's glasses. Switch to channel 2. He glanced over at Anna, who glared back at him expectantly. Jack and the others did as they were told, and almost immediately Captain Kelly and his Sentinel agents clasped the sides of their helmets. Then a burst of light shot out from the OHMD glasses they were wearing. Anna was piping in an audio sample of the alien language, as well as blinding them with a dizzying array of visuals. Jack and the others charged in at once, darting through the ever-thickening smoke to strike out. Jack brought the curved metallic bar in his hands down on the man standing before him, shearing his collarbone in two. The gun dropped from his hand and skittered across the floor, lost in the haze. Wild shots rang out as they clashed in brutal hand-to-hand combat. Mia caught sight of Brooks fleeing toward the back of the room and ran after her, a sharpened spike in her hand. Brooks turned and fired as she fled. Mia ducked behind one of the pods, watching sparks fly off the machine's shattered surface. When Brooks's weapon clicked empty, Mia swung around the other side to cut her off. They met in the middle, caught between two rows of pods. The auditory and visual assault was still underway in Brooks's helmet, and Mia moved in to take full advantage. She wasn't much of a fighter, but perhaps the distraction might help even the playing field. Mia thrust at Brooks's chest, embedding the point no more than an inch into her suit. Brooks recoiled in pain as the tip lodged into one of her ribs. She swept her hand down and knocked the weapon out of Mia's hand. Light winked off the end as it fell to the ground and out of sight. Mia moved in to strike with her fists, but Brooks raised an arm to thwart the blows and countered with one of her own. The force struck Mia in the chest, knocking the wind out of her. She stumbled back as more gunshots rang out just beyond view. Now it was Brooks's turn to charge, and both women exchanged a flurry of blows to one another's torso. When Brooks overextended with a sweeping attack, Mia hooked a leg behind her feet and pushed with all her might. Brooks tumbled to the floor. No sooner had she fallen than Mia was on top of her, wrapping her hands around Brooks's neck. From the corner of her eye, she caught sight of Brooks's left hand, searching for the spike. A second later, Brooks's fingers closed around the blunt end, and she drove it into Mia's leg. A burst of pain rose in Mia's throat as the stinging point sank into her thigh. She shrieked and used both hands to force it out. Kicking forward with her left knee, Mia used it to pin Brooks's arm down as she forced the blade's edge toward Brooks's face. When it was nearly there, Mia closed her eyes and pushed her body forward, shoving it instead through Brooks's neck. The Sentinel agent's eyes went wide before slowly fading away. Mia rolled off of her and struggled against the overwhelming urge to throw up. Close by, other individual battles were still underway. One Sentinel agent lay sprawled at Sven's feet. The other was receiving copious blows to the midsection. A few feet away, through the swirl of smoke, Jack and Captain Kelly were locked in their own deadly struggle. Like many of the others, their weapons had been the first to go. Now, only fists and sheer willpower would prevail. If ever there was a time when the warrior gene might have come in handy, this was it. But Kelly wasn't exactly rolling over and playing dead. In spite of the auditory distraction and partial blindness Anna was blaring into their helmets, he was still able to fend off Jack's attacks, and it wasn't long before Jack understood Kelly's game plan. He didn't need to beat them, he only needed to delay until it was too late. Suddenly, the ground began to vibrate, followed by that low hum which always signaled a final blast wave was powering up. But once that happened, the rock shelf the ship was balanced on would surely give way, sliding them into a fiery abyss. Kelly charged out of the haze, pinning Jack up against one of the pods. The captain's forearm pressed against Jack's throat, threatening to choke him out.
Jack struggled for air, pounding uselessly against the side of Kelly's helmet, the only area he could reach. The world began to swim away from him, his punches throwing less and less power with each passing second. The blood pooled in his head, engorging his features into a mask of fear. In a final, desperate act, Jack swung his arm across, striking the faceplate on Kelly's helmet. The sudden look of worry on his opponent's face told him to do it again, this time with everything he had. Jack cocked his elbow and struck again, this time shattering Kelly's visor. At once, Kelly released his grip and stumbled back against the wall. The brutal nature of the fight had tired both men. Kelly's lungs drew in, searching frantically for breathable air, but finding instead only a cocktail of toxic gases. The sentinel leader slumped to the floor, clutching at his throat. Chapter 67. The humming sound had nearly reached its peak when Jack ran back to the pod room's entrance. In a corner was Anna, trying to reattach one of her broken arms. Scattered around were the bodies of sentinel agents, their glasses still lit with a blinding display. But they weren't the only ones hurt. Mia emerged, shaking and covered in blood. A few paces away, Jack saw a large figure that looked a lot like Sven, slumped over. He rushed over and pulled him back. Sven gazed up at him, his eyes filled with tears. Jack's own eyes fell to the floor, where he saw Tom, dead from two bullet wounds to the chest. The humming ended, and that was when the rumbling began. "Pick him up," Jack told Sven, nudging the big man's shoulder when he didn't respond. They needed to hurry for Pod 37 and hope that it was still working. Anna and the others were already heading in that direction. When they got there, Jack ordered Anna to open the pod door. "I'm sorry, I can't do that, Dave." Biting back the rising panic, Jack paused as the reference sank in. "Yes, good one, Anna. Save it for later, would you?" "My apologies, Dr. Greer," Anna said, as she used her one good arm to activate the console and enter the command. Mia and Sven exchanged looks of fear and confusion. "She was quoting HAL 9000, Jack explained, as the glass door slid open. They piled inside as Anna plugged in the final commands. The shaking was getting worse. In the distance, water sloshed onto their level, racing toward the pod room. Anna tried to roll forward, but the pod entrance was a foot off the ground. She wasn't going to make it in. But worse, the rover they'd attached her to was too large to fit inside. With water now gushing around their feet, Sven set Tom's body down and grasped Anna by the shoulders and twisted her torso off the rover's base. When she was inside, the glass door slid shut. Then, a violent burst of G-forces followed as the pod shot up the tube. Soon, they were out of the ship, bubbles roiling past their eyes. But it was only when they burst forth from the ocean and spotted the sun shining down on them that they truly felt safe. For Jack, he had never been happier to fly in all his life.
Chapter 68. USS Grapple, Gulf of Mexico. Jack and Mia stood on the deck of the salvage ship, USS Grapple. Military blankets were draped over their shoulders, steaming mugs in their hands. He sipped at his coffee, peering over to see what she was drinking. "Green tea," she said, tilting the mug just enough for him to catch a glimpse of the light brown liquid. He smiled and went back to the blaze of beautiful colors cast off by the setting sun. Shortly after the pod had landed, a group of military men in hazmat suits had descended on them. Predictably, a battery of medical tests had followed. What lay ahead were the endless debriefings as the Navy sought to understand not only the full extent of what they had discovered on the ship, but also how things had gone so horribly wrong. Mia didn't pretend to have answers to all of those questions. Besides, there were several she was still grappling with herself. Unsettling as some of their discoveries had been, it was clear that much of what we understood of human origins on this planet would need to be rewritten. And yet, far from bringing the world closer together, Sentinel's campaign of disinformation had only driven it further apart. But Sentinel hadn't only sown dissent. They had taken the life of Tom,
a man she hadn't known for long, but what she knew of him, she had liked a great deal. At one time, a member of Sentinel, Tom had had the strength to challenge his faith in that corrupt organization and lay down his life for a noble cause he believed in. She knew Jack had felt a similar respect for Commander Hart. A hatch opened, and out came Rajesh, Anna nestled in the crook of his arm. If someone didn't know any better, they might mistake him for a ventriloquist.
"We owe you one," Jack told her.
Anna's face brightened as she reached out with her new arm. "We are even, Dr. Greer."
"Even? How so?"
Her expression grew serious. "It was largely through our interactions that I began mapping alternate neural pathways, discovering areas of myself I did not know existed."
"For better or for worse, I think we all left a bit of ourselves down there," Mia said, distinctly aware of the weight she would carry for what she had done to Brooks, even if it had been in self-defense.
"It's called growing up," Jack told Anna, lifting his mug to her in a silent cheers.
Rajesh nodded his thanks as well.
"The Navy has offered to help get Anna back on her feet, so to speak. No strings attached."
"What does that mean?" Mia wondered. He bobbed his head and grinned. "I'm not sure, but I suppose the two of us will soon find out." They turned and headed back inside, leaving Jack and Mia alone once again.
"There's an old adage that for every answer you receive, three more questions arise," Jack said, feeling the sun's warmth wash over him.
Mia laughed. "Story of my life. You starting to have regrets?" He thought about it.
"Right now, only one, although others are bound to follow."
"Really? And what's that?" She peered at him through narrowed eyes. Jack leaned in slightly, tilting his head. And for a brief moment, Mia wondered if he was about to kiss her. Instead, he said,
"I want to know why. Why an advanced race would bother with all of this. The ship wiping out an entire biosphere eons ago, only to repopulate the Earth. I've been racking my brain and can't come up with a single explanation that makes any sense. And for some reason, I just know the answer was somewhere on that ship."
His gaze fell. "I guess we'll never know." Mia's eyes sparkled as a grin formed on her soft lips. "Maybe the answer hasn't been lost." She held her battered USB key before him. "Maybe the answer is right here."
Chapter 69. The Pentagon, Washington, D.C. The emergency conference room inside the Pentagon's National Military Command Center was unusually spacious. Rectangular and with 30-foot ceilings, it seemed almost wasteful that the only furniture present was a long oak table, a remnant from the Truman era, along with a dozen or so leather chairs. The lighting here was dim, some of it pooling in the corners, the rest strung low over the men in uniform waiting patiently to begin the briefing. Hung on the walls were enormous display screens packed with maps of the United States and the world. Secretary of Defense Ford Myers, only just recently back from his time in the Gulf of Mexico, sat at the head of the table, drumming the fingers of one hand, sipping an espresso with the other. When he was finished, Myers deposited the mug, dabbed the edges of his mouth, and stared out at the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
"I'm ready."
General James F. Dunham cleared his throat and began. "At 0800 hours today, NASA satellites detected a small gamma-ray burst emanating from the planet's surface."
"Yes, I'm aware,"
Secretary Myers replied, pushing his mug off to the side, making sure the spoon stayed squarely on the saucer.
"The USO was lost shortly after that. Fell into a chasm, I believe."
Always the consummate professional, General Dunham squared his shoulders and carried on. "The burst I'm referring to came after that and was a localized event." Myers wasn't annoyed anymore. He was confused.
"Are you saying we've got another USO on our hands?"
"I'm afraid so, Mr. Secretary," Dunham replied.
"This time we determined the blast wave's area of effect was less than 50 miles. We believe it's in the beginning stages." "Where is it located?"
"Greenland," General Dunham said.
"So far, satellite imagery hasn't revealed an object. Our best guess is that it's buried somewhere under the ice sheet."
The secretary swore and rubbed the palms of his hands up and down his forehead.
"Do we have any more information on the individuals who gained access to the USO by impersonating Navy intelligence officers?"
A crack appeared in Dunham's steely composure.
The other generals looked on, expressionless, although their deep embarrassment was on full display for anyone who knew how to spot such feelings on hardened men.
"We're working on that," Dunham said, clearly anticipating the response that was to come.
"Not good enough, General. A group of terrorists, because that's what they were, terrorists, managed to enter a restricted top-secret area and steal invaluable technology right from under our noses. You're not going to tell me they didn't have help on the inside. We need to know how they did it, and we need to know now."
Dunham clicked his teeth with annoyance.
"We'll get to the bottom of it. You have my word. But there's something else you need to know, Mr. Secretary. Something more important than the infiltration."
"I doubt that very much," Myers
said, his tone spelling out his suspicions clearly enough. If the generals thought they could distract him from their incompetence, they had another think coming. General Dunham produced a black-and-white photograph and passed it down along the chain of generals on his side of the table. When it arrived before Secretary Myers, he plucked the glasses from his inside jacket pocket, slid them on, and peered down at the image.
"What the hell am I looking at?"
"Voyager 1, sir. Launched in 1977. It left our solar system sometime in 2012. She is now traveling through interstellar space and expected to reach the nearest star system sometime in the next 40,000 years. She does periodically peer back at Earth, however, and send us a snapshot or two. The scientist's idea of keeping us humble, I suppose. The image you're looking at was taken 24 hours ago."
Secretary Myers stared long and hard. Slowly, his eyes began to make sense of the smudges of light set against the dark interstellar background, and as that happened, his gaze was drawn to one particular part of the image, a blemish larger than the others, closer. Then, all at once, the realization struck him with sudden and overwhelming force, the shock so powerful it was enough to make the blood drain from his face. Even the caffeine-fueled anger once pumping through his veins dissipated like a fine mist. Without needing to be told, Myers now understood the reason for the general's deep concern. The object in the photograph was silver, shaped like a giant diamond, and headed straight for Earth.
Real life versus fiction. While Extinction Code is a work of fiction, several of the elements that went into building the story were drawn directly from newspaper headlines and magazine articles, as well as from medical and academic journals. Here are just a few. Drilling the Impact Crater. In 2016, an international team of scientists descended on the Chicxulub Impact Crater in the Yucatan Peninsula. This was the location where 65 million years ago, a meteor struck the planet and ended life not only for the dinosaurs, but for 75% of the species on Earth. Their goal was to drill down into one of the peak rings to learn more about what happened in the days and years following the meteor strike. To my knowledge, no expedition has ever set out in search of the meteorite itself. Galactic cosmic rays. Cosmic rays are bursts of high-energy particles originating from outside of our solar system. Although the source is still somewhat unclear, many scientists believe they are created by supernovae. Since they contain radiation, direct exposure to cosmic rays can alter segments of our DNA and lead to health issues. Astronauts working in space often reported seeing flashes of light whenever their eyes were closed. The cause was eventually attributed to cosmic ray particles striking their optic nerves. Such rays also pose a challenge for the prospect of long-distance manned spaceflight. In the future, spacecraft hoping to travel the vast distances between stars will require some form of shielding against various forms of radiation. Sentinel. For a variety of reasons, there are several groups and prominent individuals who believe that contact with an intelligent alien species might lead to humanity's demise. Among them is theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking, who suggested recently that meeting an advanced civilization could be like Native Americans encountering Columbus. That didn't turn out so well. In my research, I also came across an organization called Lifeboat, which seeks to mitigate the impact of future extinction-level events. In regards to First Contact, they say, "We are against any efforts to purposely provide our technological level and location to potentially hostile aliens." Silencing chromosomes. As with the fictional Salzburg, scientists using gene therapy have recently learned to muzzle the extra chromosome, 21, which causes Down syndrome, using a gene called XIST. In women, XIST is used to silence one of the two X chromosomes they carry, a built-in function which made repurposing the gene that much easier. Office for Outer Space Affairs. Yes, it sounds made up, but it really exists and is actually part of the UN, not the US. The full name is the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs, UNOOSA. The department staff is larger than one person, sorry Eugene, and also deals with more than the prospect of first contact. See the UN's website for any additional information. MAOA gene. The warrior gene is real and exists largely as it was described in the book. However, more research is needed in the area of human aggression to fully understand the interplay between genetic and environmental influences. Magma pockets beneath impact craters. Large enough asteroid impacts on Earth, like the one in Sudbury, Canada, have been known to create pockets of magma beneath the Earth's surface, forming what is known as an igneous intrusion. Prosimians. It should come as no surprise that several debates are currently raging within the field of primate origins. Identifying animals from the fossil record that look and behave like modern primates is easy. The challenge for most scientists is that the links between distant primate ancestors becomes more and more tenuous, especially since there was an explosion of mammalian species in the years following the extinction of the dinosaurs. So, if anyone claims they can draw a precise line from proto-primates through to Homo sapiens, you should be very skeptical. As additional species are uncovered, however, that picture will become clearer. The number 37. In a peer-reviewed work entitled The Wow Signal of the Terrestrial Genetic Code, scientists Vladimir I. Sherbach and Maxim A. Makukov have suggested there are mysterious patterns of mathematical symmetry within the human genome. They've identified at least 9 occasions in which the number 37 occurs. They believe this lends weight to the idea that humans were bioengineered by an intelligent species. Similarly, other scientists such as Paul Davies have argued for a concept called biological SETI, the idea being that if humans were engineered by an advanced alien species, signs of such a manipulation would likely reside in our DNA. Dedication. A special thank you to Dr. Ricky Lewis from the DNA Science Blog and Dr. Joel Rubin for helping to make sense of the incredible and often mystifying world of genetics. To Lisa Weinberg and the rest of the Beta team for all of your terrific feedback. And finally, to my editor, RJ, for your considerable prowess and never-ending patience. Thank you for listening to Extinction Code, Book 1 in the Ancient Origins series, written by James D. Prescott, narrated by Gary Tiedemann. Coming soon in 2018, Extinction Countdown, Book 2 in the Ancient Origins series. In the meantime, we invite you to try James D. Prescott's The Genesis Conspiracy, a fast-paced archaeological thriller that will make you question everything you think you know. Deep beneath the ocean lies the secret of human origins, a discovery with the power to change history or wipe us from the earth. For over a decade, archaeologist Dr. Martin Anders has searched in vain for proof of the fabled continent of Atlantis. After raising a puzzling artifact from the ocean floor, Anders gets more than he bargained for. It is a piece of modern technology, thousands of years old. To unlock its origins, Anders and a small team of scientists and ex-special forces will travel to a distant land